Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be called to order. Today is Friday, July 20th, 2012. I apologize for the late start. We're working on a it was brought to my attention that being that the chairman here is part of the litigants in a lawsuit, we are waiting for an attorney to discuss with us on whether there's part of this committee that we can be involved with. So that was the reason for the delay. We'll get to that later. You know, I received several calls, and I've seen reports accusing Secretary of State Ritchie of actively campaigning against the voter ID amendment. And as the Secretary of State falls under the jurisdiction members of this committee, I felt it was our duty to investigate these allegations and claims further in a very transparent way. And so I made the decision to ask you all to attend this committee meeting. We have a few documents that are in your packets that I would like to review before we begin any testimony. The first one would be Statute 10A.01, specifically in reference to Subdivision 9. If you would take a look at that. Subdivision 9, campaign expenditure or expenditure means the purchase or payment of money or anything of value or an advance of credit made or incurred for the purpose of influencing the nomination or election of a candidate or for the purpose of promoting or defeating a ballot question. An expenditure is considered to be made in the year in which the candidate made the purchase of goods or services incurred or incurred an obligation to pay for goods or services. An expenditure made for the purpose of defeating a candidate is considered made for the purpose of influencing the nomination or election of that candidate or any opponent of that candidate. That is one statute that I would like to have you keep in front of you. The other would be Statute 211B, .06, Subdivision 1. And I think with that, highlighting specifically a portion of it, the last two sentences of the Subdivision 1, that is false, and that a person knows is false or communicates to others with reckless disregard of whether it is false. So with that in front of us, I would first like to call witnesses to the stand. I would like to call Scott Newman, if he would. Welcome to the committee. We will address you, as we all know that you're one of our colleagues in the Senate, and I think it would be respectful to adhere to that. You are Senator Scott Newman, but you are testifying as a citizen of the state today. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Senator, then you may proceed with your testimony.
Well, what I wanted to bring to the committee's attention is that, unfortunately, Secretary of State Ritchie is not here today, so that we are unable to ask him questions directly or in a direct fashion as to where he has been and what he has been saying about the constitutional amendment that the legislature passed in the immediate past session. But I did note a couple of articles in some outstate Minnesota papers. The first one was a from the paper down in Marshall, Minnesota, where it says Secretary of State to discuss voter ID issues, and goes on to say that Ritchie stopped at the Independent, presumably it's the Marshall Independent, stopped at the Independent on Thursday afternoon prior to attending a meeting with some city, county, and township officials. That's dated in May of 2012. Then there is also an article that I read from the Mankato Free Press indicating that Minnesota Secretary of State Mark Ritchie met with the Free Press editorial board this week and outlined a number of questions, and then it goes on. This article goes on to indicate Secretary of State Ritchie's criticism of the photo ID amendment. And the question that comes to mind for me is whether, or number one, how many different cities did Secretary of State Ritchie visit? And is what he is doing, is it part of his official duties as a Secretary of State? Now, unfortunately, again, he's not here and we can't ask him those questions. But I believe that his legal responsibility is to implement the laws that involve elections that the legislature passes. I do not believe that it is within his responsibility as a constitutionally elected officer to travel around the state and be a proponent or an opponent of legislature that we pass. And so I wanted to bring to your attention, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that we do have some evidence that he is, at least in the outstate area, meeting with the press and giving the press his views on the constitutional amendment, which are, as have been from the very beginning through all of the committee process, very, very negative. And these articles, and I think you have copies of them in your packets, will bear me out on that. So I think the question becomes, for purposes of this portion of the hearing, is it a violation of his oath of office to travel around the state being an opponent to a piece of legislation on elections that the legislature voted? Should the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota be responsible for footing the bill? Presumably, he has to get there somehow. And if he's doing it during office hours, during normal office hours, you know, he's on or being paid in his salary his official duties as Secretary of State, and yet he is being an opponent of a piece of legislation that we passed. And I think that those are legitimate issues which this committee can get into, and I am here only to indicate that this is the evidence that I have that he has been doing this, albeit pretty sparse. And it's just unfortunate that we can't have the Secretary here and ask him directly these questions and really put the issue to rest. That's what I wanted to indicate to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, whose responsibility is it to oversee the voting system in Minnesota?
In my view,
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Goodwin, in my view, it's the Secretary of State.
Thank you, Senator. And
Senator Goodwin.
Dan, is it appropriate or inappropriate for somebody that it's their constitutional duty to oversee the voting system in Minnesota, that they should be able to give their impression of what is going to happen as a result of legislative changes in the laws?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, I think that the operative word that you used was implement. It is clearly the Secretary of State's responsibility to implement the laws that we pass. I do not believe it is within the responsibility of the Office of the Secretary of State to be a proponent or an opponent of that legislation. The Secretary of State is really part of the executive branch of the government, not part of the legislature. He has no legislative authority whatsoever. If you read the NPR News article dated April 14, 2012, he literally acknowledges that he has stepped out of his default stay out of the approach to politics line on this particular issue and has taken a very strong approach in general. And he claims that it's his job to run the elections and be a partner with local officials. But that's not at all what he's doing. What he is doing is attempting to influence the voters in the state of Minnesota on this issue. That is not his job, Senator Goodwin.
Well, Mr. Chair,
just a minute. I'd like to just to follow up on what you just said, Senator. I believe everyone has this in their folder, a letter from the Secretary of State to Chief Justice Gilday. If not, I will go through it for you. The Secretary of State makes note here that I have the ministerial duty to ensure that the ballots are properly printed, not to take a side as to whether a ballot question proposed by the legislature accurately or completely represents a constitutional amendment under consideration. He goes on to say, I therefore will not be filing a brief in this matter. So I wanted to bring that out based on the questioning that was going on, and so you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, regardless of what is in that letter to the chief judge, that is a different issue than what we're talking about. He didn't file a brief with the court. That's what he was saying. He wasn't going to file a brief. But as far as going on and telling people what he thinks that this law will do, I think that that is definitely his duty. It's his duty to tell people what he thinks this law will do and how it'll affect the voting system in Minnesota. And he is a separately elected official from the governor. He may be part of the executive branch, but he is a separately elected constitutional officer. And the people then elected him, trusted him to make sure that their voting system was fair and equal and that everybody got a chance to vote as easily as they could. Therefore, if he does make statements, I mean, it's like saying... I don't know that we can use the laws that say it's campaign-related or not campaign-related because it's not an election year for him. So he is just basically going out there and talking about the issue. And I'm sure many times it's because he's asked about his impression of the issue. If he's asked about it, I'm sure that he would have to tell them the truth about how he feels this will affect the voting system in Minnesota. So I think this is kind of a false accusation. I think it's a very strong accusation. I think we need to be really careful about making these kinds of accusations.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Goodwin. If I could respond, I'll sort of take it very briefly in reverse order. I don't think that what Secretary of State Ritchie is doing is stating the truth. I think what he is doing is stating his opinion. And stating his opinion as to whether or not a piece of legislation passed by the legislature on election issues is a good or a bad idea is not part of his job description. That's number one. Number two, as to your characterization of the letter that the chairman just referred to, it says, quote, as the state chief elections official, I have ministerial duty or a ministerial duty to ensure that the ballots are properly printed, not to take a side as to whether a ballot question proposed by the legislature accurately or completely represents a constitutional amendment under consideration. There's two points that I want to make with respect to that sentence. Is number one, it's an admission by the Secretary of State that his job is ministerial. And number two, it then goes on to make your point, Senator Goodwin, that he was not going to become involved in the lawsuit that was filed, even though he was a named party to that lawsuit, which I just found was incredible. But those are the two points that I wanted to make with respect to that sentence.
All right, thank you.
To this point?
Senator Gazelka.
To the point. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, because as I was reading the letter from Mark Ritchie to Judge Gildea. The third part I would say in there is he's acknowledging that it's not his responsibility to take a position, which tells me that he must have some knowledge of these statutes about what his responsibility is. And under 211B.06, where it talks about with respect to a ballot question, promote or defeat, if it's false or the person knows it's false, communicates to others with reckless disregard. While I was reading the, I think it's in everybody's packet, the KAAL-TV interview, about four paragraphs down, he says, Mark Ritchie, the Secretary of State, says the amendment would also eliminate the state's ability to do same-day registration as well as complicate absentee ballots. This amendment never eliminated same-day registration, so that is misleading. And so that's where I can see he's clearly out of bounds on what his authority is here.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Goodwin, you made an interesting statement, and I don't know if that's expressing your view or if you're also attributing it to the Secretary of State, but you said specifically that to see that everybody gets a chance to vote. Our elections law and our Constitution doesn't provide that everybody gets a chance to vote. There are legal requirements for that voting and that privilege, and that's to be a citizen of this country and to meet the conditions of the law, which is residence for a certain length of time in a particular area. Those are laws, and those are some limits on who, in fact, and we relative to convicted felons. So everybody doesn't get a chance to vote, and to suggest that it's that job to see that everybody does is a little bit frightening, because it means that we should be ignoring that there's some people here that believe that we should ignore those kinds of provisions and do whatever it takes just to see that everybody votes. And that's part of the concern that I think has aroused the citizens of this state to believe that there's got to be real meaning to what it is to vote in these United States, in this state, and why they like the idea that there is some identification and assurance that that is in fact the case.
Mr. Chair, to that point, please.
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Olson, I think if I missed the word legally able to vote, eligible to vote, I'm sorry, but I think everybody understood that basically. That I think that four-year-olds should be able to vote, or people that are not citizens should be able to vote, because they shouldn't. But I think it's pretty simple explanation, and I certainly don't think you really think that I'm that stupid. I'm sorry, you didn't say that, right?
And I don't regard you as stupid. I'm just saying that words matter, and the exclusion of words also matter, and we of all people need to be clear in what we are saying.
Understood. Mr. Chair, to just say
Senator
one more
Goodwin.
Thing. What I see this as now is an effort to limit free speech, for one thing, by an executive officer of the state, and to interfere with the system of checks and balances and decide who can say what in an executive branch or a judicial branch is not our job. Thank you.
Do you have anything else? I do know that we have another testifier here that would.
I have
like
nothing
to.
Further, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Torres-Ray, you were first. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for the chairman. As I read, you know, the articles that have been presented to us, one could continue to ask the questions about, you know, where does it say this and how do I interpret this and. Clearly, the question as to who is responsible for visiting the counties and explaining how this is going to work, I think we all know that that is the responsibility of the Secretary of State. It's his obligation. We expect him to go around and let the public know how this is going to be implemented. So we can go back and forth about the words that he used and whether or not he was campaigning, whether or not he agreed or disagree. And I think we're going to disagree. You and I are going to disagree, and Senator Newman and I are going to disagree, and we can have these for endless hours. So my question, Mr. Chairman, is do we have people from the counties who are actually going to implement this legislation, who met with the Secretary of State, who can tell us whether or not that meeting was a political meeting, it was about the implementation of this law, or it was simply about, you know, stating what our political views are about these issues. We have very strong opinions about these issues, Mr. Chairman, and you know that. You know that. And we can express that during this hearing, and we will continue to campaign, some of us, against this. very strongly, some of you very strongly for it. So my question really is here, is this hearing intending to ask the people who are responsible for the implementation as to how these meetings have transpired, whether or not they are getting the information from the Secretary of State to actually conduct their work, not to do the politics. We are campaigning, Mr. Chairman, and we will campaign on these issues. So I don't want to entertain questions. I don't think it is really appropriate for us to entertain our questions as to how do we feel about these amendments. I think we need to ask the counties. We need to know if they have the information and if they have received the information from the Secretary of State's office, because technically they are responsible for providing that information. So I would like to ask, Mr. Chairman, if we are moving in that direction.
Senator Torres-Ray, we are, and I believe our next testifier will probably be able to shed some light on that. I think what we have been trying to get to here from the calls that I have received is that we understand that even out of the HAVA funds, that the Secretary of State's office is to go and train and to work with local election officials. I don't believe anyone here sees anything wrong with that. It is when it comes back to us that prior to the start of that or within that educational process, the Secretary of State or members of his office articulate opposition to and make statements that are not true about what could happen if this law were to pass, this amendment were to pass. That, I believe, is what the citizens are questioning. Is there an active campaign by the Secretary of State's office, whether it's using his own campaign dollars or using taxpayer dollars to actually campaign against a constitutional amendment? And I think that's what the citizens are concerned about. And that's we're going to move to that direction. We'll get there. Let me move on to Senator Wigger. Did you still have a question, sir?
Well, a comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, each of us is entitled to our opinion. However, I want to state that I feel the Secretary of State not only has a right but a responsibility to respond to questions, to offer his or her opinion on a public policy matter. There's the ministerial duty for putting it on the ballot, and that's going to be done. Voters will decide soon enough, and most have decided. I think this is more of a politically charged atmosphere, which most people don't appreciate. The concerns that some of you have raised by citing some editorial clips, there's discussion out there on these topics, and we're going to ask our state constitutional officers elected by the people of Minnesota to be mute on subjects. If you handed out campaign expenditure items, if you're concerned on that, then you know the jurisdiction to do that. This is not the forum, though I strongly feel, regardless of one's political party, you have a right to opinion. And there's been so many groups, whether it's the League of Women Voters or many churches, congregations that are involved on various points of these issues. There's lots of questions out there. So the Secretary of State can offer an opinion. I just don't like the nature of being tried by editorial clips. And we just have a skeleton of an agenda here, and we really don't need to go much further, I believe.
Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me, last time I checked, even though I'm not directly engaged, there's an election this November. And it seems to me the Secretary of State should be out working with the counties to assure that the laws that we are in place, that it's clear as to what, in fact, needs to be done to be doing the very best job of a very important election this November. I think to be out spending time with county officials talking about what might or might not happen and implications of a vote on a constitutional amendment is only confusing rather than clarifying and assuring that we have a well-managed election this November. And I think that that, you know, maybe it's because I have spent a few years in education, that you don't want to muddy the waters by what might be. When the election is over, the outcome of that election in terms of the constitutional amendment, which will be debated, and there's all kinds of opinions, and there'll be lots of things going on related to it. But when that's done, that's when you start looking at the implications, because we don't have another election the next day. There's an off-year election for some local elections, but it'll be 2 years, essentially, before you have another election. That's the time to be working through. The legislature will be working through refining the implementation, working with the Secretary of State, getting those things in place if, in fact, those changes are made. And I think that's very legitimate to express some concern that we are muddying the waters. The Secretary of State, our chief election officer, is actually muddying the waters to allow what might be a confusing and ill carried out election this November, and that would be a dirty shame.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to our next testifier, Mr. McGrath. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for affording me this opportunity to testify on this subject. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the Executive Director of the Government Watchdog Group Minnesota Majority, and also, significantly to the discussion we're having here, the Chairman of ProtectMyVote.com, which is a ballot committee established to advocate for ratification of the Voter ID Amendment. This is significant.
Mr. McGrath, before you proceed, your intent is to testify to what you believe is the Secretary of State, he and or his office actively campaigning against the constitutional amendment? Is that your intent here today?
Mr. Chairman, exactly.
All right. Thank you, sir.
The Secretary of State has the right of freedom of speech. I've heard this come up in this committee, that he has a responsibility to accurately describe our election process, to answer questions about constitutional amendments, anything that's going to be on the ballot, our election procedures. But in Minnesota, there's a campaign finance law where if you're going to advocate for or against a ballot question, you're required to file a ballot committee, which we have done. Now, I don't think that anyone here would say that in the United States some people are more equal than others. The First Amendment applies equally to all people, but the State of Minnesota requires this filing of expense reporting and revenue reporting if you're going to advocate for or against a constitutional amendment. So I'm here today to express concerns about the recent actions and statements of the Secretary of State and his staff. Based on my observations, news reporting, and things that I've been told by other people, eyewitnesses, I'm concerned that the Secretary of State is using his position of public trust to advance a political agenda rather than impartially administering the duties of his office. Senator Newman mentioned some of these instances. I'm concerned the taxpayer resources may be being used for political purposes, specifically to campaign against and spread misinformation about the Voter ID Amendment. Since this legislature passed the Voter ID Amendment, the Secretary of State and his staff have been traveling the state making claims about the impacts of the Voter ID Amendment that are demonstrably false. For example, in op-eds and media interviews, the Secretary of State has repeatedly claimed that some elderly people, especially older women, will be disenfranchised by voter ID because they can, quote, never get an ID, because they may lack certain vital documents required by the Department of Public Safety. This is demonstrably false. The Department of Public Safety has a variance process for people missing vital documents like birth certificates or a marriage license. It involves a one-page form to be submitted with the application for identification. The Secretary of State has claimed that if the Voter ID Amendment is adopted by the people, it can't be changed and will be in the Constitution forever. This is obviously false. If the Constitution were impossible to amend, we would not even be here today. The Secretary of State has claimed that provisional ballots are a nightmare and chaos in every other state that uses them. They're employed by 44 other states. We're one of only six that don't. Are we to believe that elections in all but six states are nightmarish chaos? The Secretary has claimed that provisional ballots will delay election results, which is also demonstrably false. Indiana has a similar voter ID law to our proposed constitutional amendment. Their voting population is similar to Minnesota's. In the high turnout election of 2008, Indiana had fewer than 4,000 provisional ballots cast. Superimpose that onto Minnesota's 4,000 voting precincts, approximately. You're looking at an average of less than one provisional ballot per precinct. Any election that could be decided by such a small number of votes would trigger Minnesota's mandatory recount laws, which take far longer than certifying and counting provisional ballots. Therefore, provisional ballots cannot delay election results. The Secretary of State has repeatedly claimed the Voter ID Amendment will eliminate Election Day registration, which is impossible. The Voter ID Amendment doesn't say anything about Election Day registration. Election Day registration is a matter of current statute, and in order to change that, it would require a statutory bill passed by this legislature and signed by the governor. Unless the Secretary believes that Governor Dayton wants to eliminate Election Day registration, which he's on record as saying he does not, it's obvious that that's not going to happen. Secretary Ritchie has claimed that deployed military voters will be unable to vote as a result of the Voter ID Amendment. As the state's chief election official, one might expect that he'd be aware of the Federal Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, also known as UOCAVA, and MOVE Act. Military absentee voting is governed by federal law, and no state law, not even a constitutional amendment, can override that federal process. So this is another demonstrable falsehood. I mention the Secretary's repeated false statements to demonstrate that he is not merely providing voters and election officials information about the Voter ID Amendment, but has clearly crossed the line into actively campaigning against the amendment. Minnesota majority and several lawmakers have filed suit against Ritchie for his attempt to change the title of the Voter ID Amendment from the clear and obvious language, photo identification required to vote, to changes to in-person and absentee voting and voter registration provisional ballots. This new title doesn't even contain the words photo ID, which is what voters interested in the issue will be looking for on the ballot. This appears to be nothing but a cynical, biased, and hyperpartisan ploy to suppress affirmative votes for the amendment by creating voter confusion. This is a matter that will ultimately be settled by the Minnesota Supreme Court, but I mention it as another example of how I believe the Secretary of State is misusing his position of public trust and his office. The Secretary of State has deployed his staff across the state conducting what are ostensibly training sessions for local election officials. According to news reports and eyewitnesses, a significant part of that training has involved the same kinds of information about the Voter ID Amendment. Why do election officials working on the 2012 election need training on voter ID when, if ratified, the Voter ID Amendment won't take effect until July of 2013? I have two major concerns that I believe this committee should investigate. First, the Secretary of State appears to be actively campaigning against the Voter ID Amendment. I believe he may be required to form a ballot committee and report all expenditures and sources of revenue in his campaign. He has not done so and may be in violation of Minnesota campaign finance law. Second, it appears the Secretary of State may be using taxpayer resources to campaign against the Voter ID Amendment, which I'm quite certain is illegal. I recall the Secretary of State has run into trouble for this sort of thing before. It's my hope that this committee will fully investigate the actions of the Secretary of State, including a review of his calendar and expense reimbursements, the calendars and expense reimbursements of all employees in the office, whether the Secretary was required to form a ballot committee, and whether he has used state resources in a political campaign. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for counsel.
Senator Goodwin.
Ms. James, could you tell me how many states, Mr. McGrath said 44 states have this legislation. How many of those states have it in their constitution?
Ms. James.
Senator Goodwin and committee members, I'm advised by Council Stengel that there is one state, but it is not in effect yet.
Right, and that would
Senator
be
Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. And that would be Mississippi is the only other state. So, in other words, all of the rest of the states that have language have it in their law. So if they need to make changes to it, if it's not working right, that's very easy to do. With this one being in our Constitution, we will only be in the same box as Mississippi is. So I really want to make that clear when we talk about how many other states have this legislation. It's a completely different thing putting in the Constitution than having it in law.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a reminder that the year before we actually passed it legislatively, but it was vetoed by the governor, so this was our only recourse. But I do have a question for Mr. McGrath, and you may or may not know this. My research shows that in Minnesota, the Secretary of State has never changed a title to an amendment that was adopted by the legislative bodies, and particularly for the marriage amendment. The title was submitted by a DFL senator and passed 49-16, so it clearly was bipartisan when you only have 37 Republicans. But can you verify that? If not, I'm going to ask whoever the representative is for the Secretary of State. But I don't think there ever has been one where the Secretary of State arbitrarily changed a title and, in this case, made them very unclear.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, our legal counsel has investigated this issue in the title lawsuit that we've launched this week, and the information that you have is accurate. Mr. Chair, if I may also clarify my remarks that Senator Goodwin was asking about. The 44 states that I was referring to was in regard to provisional ballots, which are mandated by federal law. 44 states use provisional ballots. 44 states do not necessarily have a voter ID requirement.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to ask a question regarding that 44 states, because it wasn't clear in your question, Senator Goodwin. You said pass this law. What law? Which part of it? And it seemed to me that you had been talking about provisional balloting, not voter ID, and I'm not sure how the council was responding in terms of the one state, if that was the whole enchilada, or if it was just the provisional balloting part that you addressed.
Ms. James.
Senator Olson and members of the committee, I was answering that there is one state that has voter ID in its constitution.
All right, thank you. I think at this time I'm going to ask Mr. Goldsmith if he would come forward. Dan, you can, if you'd just stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board.
Busy time for you this season, I'm sure.
It is, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to go back to statements that are coming forth about the campaigning against a constitutional amendment, specifically based under the Section 10A.01, Subdivision 9, Campaign Expenditure. And maybe I could start, Mr. Goldsmith, by asking, should Secretary of State Ritchie be reporting expenses through his campaign, or maybe you can shed some light on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can shed some light on the questions and the issues. I would not purport to answer the question that the chair has proposed as to whether Secretary Ritchie should be registering and reporting with the board, because I think there are too many facts that are not known for me to give an answer. And secondly, if the answer is one that is subject to controversy, only the board could provide an official answer to that. But having said that, let me shed at least some light on the relevant statutes. The chair is correct in citing the definition of expenditure or campaign expenditure as including costs of promoting or defeating ballot questions. However, as in many other cases, Chapter 10A just isn't quite that simple. The chapter also includes in the same provision that the chair has cited, the definition of campaign expenditure or expenditure, a statement that says expenditure does not include non-campaign disbursements as defined in Subdivision 26. Before I actually get to Subdivision 26, let me say that there has never been an understanding of the board, and Chapter 10A does not suggest that the ordinary costs of running either a body of the legislature or a constitutional office would come within the jurisdiction of Chapter 10A. Costs of serving in public office or running a public office are typically outside the jurisdiction of Chapter 10A, which is the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Act. So when those costs are paid with the budgets for those bodies, we don't expect to see those things on campaign finance reports. Likewise, particularly with members of the legislature, sometimes those costs have to be paid with legislators' own money because there just isn't enough in their budget, and so they make up some of that on their own. We don't expect those things to show up on campaign finance reports either. And then the statute provides a specific exemption if a candidate decides to use campaign money to pay those costs, and that's called a non-campaign disbursement. And there is a non-campaign disbursement that specifically says even if you use your campaign money to pay for costs of serving in office, it's not a campaign expenditure. So it doesn't affect your spending limits or apply to those limits. Taking those in sum, I would have to say that the board's interpretation of Chapter 10A over the years has been that costs of serving in public office are simply something that does not trigger any kind of campaign finance registration or reporting requirement unless campaign funds of an existing committee are used for them, in which case they would be disclosed. Having said that, of course, there is the provision about ballot questions. And there are actually two questions that have been mentioned already, and again, I won't purport to answer, but the first question is whether the actions or the alleged actions of the Office of the Secretary of State and of the Secretary of State himself are, in fact, part of the official actions of that office. That's a question I think would be outside of the board's jurisdiction. It would be more appropriately answered possibly by the judicial system in a declaratory judgment action. But if the board were forced to confront that question in the case of a complaint, for example, being filed with the board or even an advisory opinion being filed with the board, I think that board would be very cautious in approaching that question and would typically defer to the judgment of the body of the legislature or the state agency itself or the constitutional office in determining what its official duties are. And if the board did exercise that deference to the body or to the constitutional office, of course, that exercise would be subject to judicial review. As I said, I think, in my opinion, judicial review should come first in the form of a declaratory judgment action before a matter would even be brought before the board. So the first question, and one that I cannot answer, is whether the alleged actions of the secretary are, in fact, part of the official duties of the office. If they are, I think then that the statute, Chapter 10A, and the long history of applying Chapter 10A would suggest at least that those transactions would not be subject to or governed by Chapter 10A because, again, of the deference that the board gives to other legislatively and constitutionally created institutions. The board is a state agency in the executive branch. We are independent from the governor, as from all other executive offices, and in fact exercise a good deal of independence from the legislature, having been created as an agency that has oversight over both constitutional officers and the legislature. The board has been careful to guard its independence. So the question then would be, if you have a series of actions that a constitutional officer has decided are within the purview of that office, are in fact part of the official duties of that office, and those actions also are determined to be to influence, that is, to promote or defeat a ballot question, where does Chapter 10A come down on that? I would add one more caveat that I think there's a question still as to whether the actions are to promote or defeat a ballot question or rather are educational. That question is very much in contention. I have not looked at statements or articles, and that would be a fact question that would have to be answered. But let's assume, for the purpose of argument, that some of those actions would be determined to be to promote or defeat, and in this case, I guess, to defeat a ballot question by influencing voters. The board would then be required to determine whether the deference and the exception for operating a constitutional office in its official capacity outweighs the Chapter 10A provision that requires reporting of ballot question expenditures. And that's something that would truly need to be reserved for the board. I have not done the legal research to see what case law might be applicable to that question. Certainly, we are would be looking mm-hmm. at not only First Amendment rights, but also the rights of independent, constitutionally created bodies in the state of Minnesota, and the board would be cautious in that area. I think, secondly, the board would probably review whether Chapter 10A, should it decide to go the route of requiring some sort of disclosure, whether Chapter 10A is carefully crafted or even necessary for that purpose. And in the context of that, it would be necessary to review what other sources are available to the public to show how the Secretary of State's office might be using its resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. That brings a question to mind. Has the board ever had the occasion to look at or discuss at what point in time a constitutional officer or a legislator leaves that position and moves into a campaign mode in their daily walk? I mean, has the board ever had to look at situations such as that and make a determination, though I believe you're going to say it's not black and white when, in this case, the Secretary of State doing an educational visit and at the same time, many believe, varies and moves away from the educational side to a campaign mode against. I mean, has the board ever had to look at that kind of a situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Specifically with respect to the question of when an official, be it a constitutional officer or a legislator, moves from the official capacity into some other personal capacity, the board has not had any occasion to address that question. However, I think it's somewhat more black and white than one might expect when first beginning to think about it. For example, if the Secretary of State uses campaign committee resources to pay for his trips around the state, if he's going around the state, or to pay for things, whether or not he agrees that they are for the purpose of influencing a ballot question, if he uses campaign resources, they will be disclosable because everything that a campaign committee uses its money for is disclosed. If the Secretary of State, and again, I use this for shorthand, but that's who you're talking about here today. It applies equally to other constitutional officers or legislators. If an official decides to do something on the official's own and acknowledges that this is not an official duty of the office, but rather something the official is doing on his or her own, that position is fairly clear as well. That would be a campaign activity if it is for the purpose of promoting or defeating a ballot question. So if I were governor and I said, you know, that this is not the office of the governor, but Gary Goldsmith as governor traveling the state to defeat a ballot question on my own, not using state resources or my campaign resources, I would have a reporting obligation with the board if I spent enough money to meet the threshold. So I would report the use of my own money. If I band together with other people to do that, I would be forming a campaign committee, in this case a ballot question committee, and again I would have a registration and reporting obligation to the board. So the question again gets back to whether these activities that are being alleged are something that's done within the context of the official duties of the office or outside of those duties. If they're done inside the official duties of the office, questions about the board's role in inquiring into the funding and spending of that office arise. If they're done outside of those official duties, then disclosure is fairly clear.
Based on your answer there, I'm wondering if you were giving us an indication of your political future in 2014.
I hope to be retired by then.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Mr.
Chair.
Senator Wiegand.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question. Mr. Goldsmith, Senator Newman had indicated earlier that he wasn't here as a senator but as a layperson or a citizen, and would that then, depending on his activism, potentially trigger some requirements then under Chapter 10?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator Wigger, members, Mr. Chair, with a specific example, I would think probably not, at least partly because it wouldn't reach a financial threshold. But if somebody, we have a number of people who have contacted us as individuals who are going to go around the state doing things. Some are putting up billboards just all by themselves and so on. If they meet the financial threshold, they would have to report. I don't know, replaying the senator's testimony in my brain, I don't know if his testimony actually would be considered to be for the purpose of it promoting or defeating the ballot question, and I won't venture a guess on that one.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I listened to Mr. McGrath talk about numerous quotes that were either false or, according to Chapter 211B, communicates to others with reckless disregard of whether it is false. Is that outside of your jurisdiction, that area, and that's why that isn't part of what you look at, or could you clarify that for me?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Sure. Senator Gazelka, members. Yes, Chapter 10A is the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Act. Chapter 211B is the Fair Campaign Practices Act. Chapter 10A, for the most part, doesn't prohibit any conduct. It's really all about limits and disclosure. And when you start talking about conduct, you're typically going to be under Chapter 211B, and that's where the false statements problems arise, if they arise anywhere, not under Chapter 10A.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
So who has oversight over that chapter?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, and members, this is something I've talked to this committee and other committees about before. I will talk to you, those of you who I see again in January, about the same subject. Chapter 211B is, in part at least, an orphan chapter. That is, there is no state agency and no body that answers questions or issues advisory opinions about it. If you have a problem under Chapter 211B, you can file a complaint with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they'll rule on that complaint. And then there's some precedent for that situation if it comes up again. But if you have a question, for example, about what kind of disclaimer do I need to put on my campaign material, or can I use my campaign money for this particular purpose, there is nobody who can help you. And this board, my board, has asked in the past for some very limited jurisdiction over that chapter to answer questions that we're already answering for people as a courtesy and unofficially, but there is no agency that can help you there.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further, Mr. McGrath?
No.
All right. Again, I think just to wrap up this portion, I would like to draw attention to the letter that I brought up before, which was dated June 14, 2012, to Chief Justice Laurie Gilday, where our Secretary of State made the statement, signed it, as the state's chief elections official. I have the ministerial duty to ensure that the ballots are properly printed, not to take a side as to whether a ballot question proposed by the legislature accurately or completely represents a constitutional amendment under consideration. I believe we would like to move on. Part of this was to discuss the calls that we have received in reference to whether what the Secretary of State did in changing the title of the amendments and what the AG, the Attorney General, did in approving it is constitutional, whether or not it is. The Secretary of State and the Attorney General, both, again, committee, are under this jurisdiction, and I just think it's important that we delve into those allegations as well. Before we start taking testimony, if we have some here, I would like to draw your attention to Article 9 of the Minnesota Constitution. You have copies in your packet under Section 1, Amendments and Ratification. And I think for the public, I'll read this. It's a paragraph long. A majority of the members elected to each house of the legislature may propose amendments to this Constitution. And with that, I'm not sure if we had a testifier. We were told that we would. Why don't we call Mr. Bert Black, I believe it is, from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Please state your name.
My name is Bert Black. I'm here today to represent the Office of the Secretary of State. I am the legal advisor within the Office of the Secretary of State. I am employed by the Secretary of State's office. I've been with the office since June 26, 1981. I've worked in the area of election law since October 25, 2002. And I've been the legal advisor since January 7th, 2003. I'm glad to answer questions within the limits of my personal knowledge and the additional limits imposed by the ongoing litigation, the rules of professional conduct, the rules of evidence. I am not authorized to violate or waive any of these. There are multiple lawsuits in which the Secretary is a party, including two cases where one or more members of this committee are named represented adverse parties. It's not appropriate to argue those cases here today. There is a brief that's been filed in the case, and that brief should be responsive to a number of your anticipated questions. I think that the representatives of the Attorney General's office who are representing us in those cases would respond to legal questions in that case. Otherwise, I'm glad to answer questions, and if I may, I would like to start by talking, if I might, about the letter of June 14th, I think it was, 2012, June 14th, 2012, which has been cited a couple of times during this discussion. And I simply wish to point out that the letter is narrowly crafted with respect to the particular case for which it was written. That case, the League of Women Voters case, that case involves a lawsuit, a petition that the question, and when I say question, I don't mean ballot question as in the entire amendment. I mean the question, which is the wording which will appear on the ballot immediately above where it says yes or no. And I don't mean the title. I mean the question. That the Secretary's ministerial authority is cited in that letter is simply for the wording of the question and not anything else. So I would ask that everybody understand that that is not meant to apply more broadly than to the question. The question was in chapter, in this case, chapter 167, which you passed this past session. And the Secretary does not have any particular duties with respect to the question. And so please understand that that letter is only, when it talks about ministerial duties, it's only applying to the ballot question language that was sued over in the League of Women Voter case.
So, Mr. Black, are we to believe that his ministerial duties then change considerably from one item to another?
I think that depends on the statutes provided by the legislature. There's a statute in there are hundreds of pages of election law statutes. It provides the Secretary with ministerial tasks in some cases and discretionary tasks in others. I can't give you, I'm not prepared to give you, and we don't have time to go over a section-by-section analysis, although I could produce one given enough time.
Well, Mr. Black, then let me ask you this, being you brought up the June 14th letter. Do you agree with the Secretary of State when he says that it is not for him to take a side as to whether a ballot question proposed by the legislature accurately or completely represents a constitutional amendment under consideration?
He didn't take a side in, Mr. Chairman, he didn't
take a
side.
Do you believe in that statement?
He did not take a side in the lawsuit.
Well, I'm just asking, based on what he says here, do you agree with that statement?
I agree with that statement in the to the extent or in the sense to understand that statement that it says the ballot question language is not material on which he has an official opinion or a role.
When, Mr. Black, then, when is it his duty to take sides, if that's the case?
It is the Secretary of State's duty to provide information when asked, and he has been doing that, to my understanding, knowledge, and belief.
And that information should be true and accurate?
That information should be true and accurate, yes.
If we take a look at the article, was there any other question along that from anyone? All right. If we take a look at the Article 9 amendments to the Constitution, do you believe that Article 9 of the Minnesota Constitution gives the legislature the power to propose amendments?
I think that's that is a question that's under litigation, and I think Mr. Gilbert should or his associate should respond to that question. I guess I would say I think the constitutional section speaks for itself in terms of proposal. What proposal means is another matter.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Black, do you believe that Chapter 204D.15 gives the Secretary of State the ability to provide a title for a constitutional question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin. I believe it requires the Secretary to provide a title, and similar language has required that since 1919. And in fact, mention was made earlier of whether the Secretary had ever changed a title. I guess I would submit that the legislature had not attempted to provide a title, and I say attempted, until 2008 and 2011 and 2012. And the cases of 2011 and 2012 are in litigation.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Black, was there any legal reason for the Secretary of State to change the title?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Thompson, I guess I would say I don't think he changed it. I think he provided it. I don't think there was a title that was in force at the time that the Secretary set the title.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Black, well, the legislature did provide a title that the legislature approved and wanted on the ballot, so the Secretary of State chose to do something different. I believe that would be a change, wouldn't it?
Mr. Black?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Thompson, I guess I don't know if you can change something that was improper in the first place.
Why? Explain yourself, Mr. Black. Why do you believe it was improper?
Mr. Chairman, there was a statute in place, 204D.15. The statute provides for the Secretary to set the title.
Senator Thompson?
No, that was basically my follow-up.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Black, does the Constitution preempt the statute?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, the Constitution surely preempts the statutes. The question will be, what does the Constitution mean?
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, I have one. It's not related to the last discussion, but
Senator Gazelka.
May, Mr. Black, and you may or may not be able to answer this, frankly, I was hoping that the Secretary of State himself would be here. It's actually troubling that he's not. But in our packet, I was looking at two letters, one dated June 15th and the other one July 3rd. They were both letters from the Secretary of State to the Attorney General changing the titles, as we assert. It's just another thing of many that causes me to be troubled and feel that he's meddling. But this one in particular, my background is in the financial services industry. That's what I do. I know Senator Carlson does as well. And we saw these for the first time today. When it comes to signatures, that's a really, really important thing. You don't draw somebody else's signature. When you sign your name to a document, it's you, and you verify that. And as I look at these two letters, the signatures on the bottom are clearly different from each other. Mark Ritchie, Mark Ritchie. You know, June 15th, that's the signature I regularly see under Mark Ritchie, but the July 3rd, I have no idea who that is. And so I'm just wondering if you know who signed Mark Ritchie's signature on the bottom of that letter.
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, I believe that's an electronic signature. Electronic signatures are permitted under Chapter 325L. They are given the exact same legal rights and standing as a real pen on ink signature. They are a real signature. If your comment is that the electronic signature varies from the personal signature, I think the letters, you can see the letters, but it makes it no less valid.
Senator Gazelka.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Black, if that is the case, then I will retract that. But I would, if it's possible, I would like to get a copy of that electronic signature just to verify that what you say is true. It just, to me, it looks so different there with the T crossed. And, you know, I often see his other one because I see a lot of material come through him. Mm-hmm. But the other one is like if you were a bank teller, if you were somebody with financial securities, you would look at those two signatures and say something's not right. And if there's a way for you guys to send me a copy of the electronic, I would appreciate that.
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Gazelka, that's a fair question. I'd be glad to do that. What I would do is propose to do is to send it to you in the form of an email from either the Secretary's address or from my email address, which is, well, I can give that to you later.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I didn't see who was first. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've still been reflecting on this, the statutory requirement for the Secretary of State to provide a title versus the legislature including the title in the amendment. You indicated that there was, for years, the legislature didn't put titles in, but it was a title was required to be put on the ballot. So therefore, the Secretary of State provided that and, in fact, wrote it. I haven't looked up the definition of provide, but if there's anything, how specific that is. But when the legacy amendment went on, that the legislature did include the title, and the Secretary of State put it on the ballot. Now, was he providing a title? Was he meeting his statutory obligation, or was he actually disregarding his statutory obligation by accepting one from the legislature? Because I think that's what's at issue here. In these two, the legislature did identify titles, and he didn't provide them. He rewrote them. And maybe it's a wording clarification, and I don't know what the legal ramifications are of that word provide and what power it gives, and if it does, in fact, as it was raised, override the Constitution in terms of whether the legislature can, in fact, have that as a part of that Constitution or that proposed amendment or not.
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I guess the question about the constitutional issue I'll leave to the Attorney General. I would say that the Secretary of State did send to the counties on June 1st, 2008, in the example ballot for the state general election, a title for use in that general election. The title was the same as provided in the legacy amendment law, which I believe was Chapter 151 of the laws of 2008.
Okay, Mr. Chair. But you're,
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, but you are then, Mr. Black, you are stating then that the you believe that the Secretary of State does have the authority to override. He has the greater authority than the legislature carrying out their constitutional authority of providing for the ballot to put the title on, and therefore he can override, in fact, what the legislature does. I know that's the question before the court, I believe, so, but it's kind of interesting that you are defending that he didn't shirk it. He did get it on the ballot, but that he does have the power to override what the legislature does.
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I would simply say that, yes, that is the question before the court. And, again, that goes back to the original answer I gave to another senator about what does proposal mean. And there will be a certain point where the court will decide how far proposal goes and where it ends and where other things begin.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
To that same point, it's very clear in statute here, 204D.15, it says the Secretary of State shall provide. It's not an option for the Secretary of State. He or she shall provide an appropriate title for each question printed on the pink ballot. Now, if the Secretary of State decide to keep the same title as the legacy amendment, then the Secretary of State would have that ability. Under statute, there's nothing in statute that says the legislature must provide, but there is something in statute that says the Secretary of State shall provide. So I think the delineation is pretty clear here.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Black, you indicated earlier, which any lawyer would, that the Constitution obviously trumps statute. And what we have is the Minnesota Constitution says that the right to propose amendments to the Constitution, which is found in Article 9, says that, quote, a majority of the members elected to each house of the legislature may propose amendments to the Constitution, unquote. In a case, I don't have the full name of it, but it's the Stearns case found at 75 Northwest 2nd, and particularly on page 218, the court has ruled the judgment and discretion of the legislature should be interpreted to include, quote, the manner of submitting the question of the amendment to the people, unquote. Would not the title be a part of the manner of submitting the amendment?
Mr. Black.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Thompson, okay, now again, that's one of the questions before the court, and I'm going to need to defer to the Attorney General because he represents us in that case.
Senator Thompson?
She represents us, excuse me. Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just revisit Senator Gazelka's question about the electronic signature. Mr. Black, when would it be usual and customary, excuse me, my voice is gone, for an official to use this electronic signature option as opposed to personally signing a document?
Mr. Black?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, I think it's legal at any time. Chapter 325L is the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, and it's meant to promote the use of all sorts of electronic forms, both in commerce and government. I think it would be used when the person in question approved of the letter but was not there physically to sign it. But, certainly intent to sign, that is a requirement of any signature, whether electronic or otherwise.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so, Mr. Black, what safeguards do we have that signature could not be
I don't know if it would be stolen or, you know, we have computer hacking all the time and people can get into other people's emails. It would certainly seem to me that someone would be able to get into someone's electronic signature and use it unauthorized. So what safeguards do we have for that?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, you raised an interesting question. There is not as much trouble with signatures such as you see here, which are, in fact, graphic reproductions. Particularly, I can tell you that in the Office of the Secretary of State, we have a log of when various stamps and other graphic reproductions of what have you are used. The access to this is controlled. With respect to in general commerce, let me, this is not really part of this hearing, but I have to tell you that in case law going back probably 150 years, your including telegrams and other previous modes of communication, your name printed at the bottom of a communication is your signature, is equivalent to your signature, if you had intent to sign the document. If you don't have intent to sign the document, then the issues that you raise do arise. Those would be questions in common commercial fraud issues. If somebody were impersonating somebody and by sending emails and putting somebody else's name at the bottom of it, that's not the case here.
Mr. Chair,
excuse me, Senator Carlson, finish your.
Just a follow-up comment. It would just seem to me, Mr. Chair and members, that something of this nature is very serious, where Secretary of State is usurping the authority of the legislature by changing the nature of the title of an amendment. And chooses to use an electronic signature instead of actually signing, it just seems a little curious to me.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Just an aside, don't try to get a Senate resolution passed without Cal Ludeman's actual signature, our Secretary of the Senate, because it won't be done in any other form. So you would admit, I had recent experience with that.
All right. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black. Would you agree that the governor's symbolic veto of this legislation had no impact on the legislation at all, the content, the title, anything, no actual impact?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, I think the brief we have filed in this case, which may be discussed by later witnesses, disagrees with that, and I personally disagree with that statement.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Black, so you have now rendered a legal opinion on that. Did you believe that the governor's symbolic veto or veto had an actual impact upon the legislature's choice of a title?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, since you have characterized what I said as a legal opinion, and you may be right, I think I better not say anything more until the Attorney General, my attorney, speaks.
Senator Thompson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Black, let me restate it. If you stated it as an individual and not as a lawyer, then I'm interested in the follow-up to that. But you did give us the opinion on the issue, so I'm interested in the follow-up. Do you believe that the title was effectively vetoed by the governor?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, in the previous answer I said I personally, and when I say personally I mean as an individual, and I'll say it again, I personally do believe that the title was vetoed.
Thank you.
Anything further? Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Black, I'm referring to a column that appeared in the Pioneer Press. And it refers to the change in title that we are discussing today, changes to in-person and absentee voter and voter registration provisional ballots. Richie, who is well-read and well-spoken, clearly had to go deep into the Orwellian playbook to come up with that one. It is a bizarre formulation and obviously seeks to obscure the initiative and confuse the voter. Mr. Black, what we're talking about in this amendment is that voters have the ability to vote and have their vote count. It feels to me like what Secretary Ritchie has done is he has tried to, in fact, suppress the vote by selecting a title that obscures what the amendment is trying to achieve. Would you agree with that statement?
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly, I would not agree with that statement because, if you'll excuse my looking at my phone, I have the constitutional amendment on my phone. I'm sorry about that. The constitutional amendment speaks to a number of different new provisions. It contains a number of different new provisions. The purpose of the title is to provide, excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you. To provide the voters with as broad a possible description of all of the material, or as many of the material parts of the amendment that can be fit onto the one line that's required by the statute. That is certainly a drafting challenge because, as I say, there are a number of different provisions. But that is the aim of the title the Secretary provided.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, in taking that into consideration then, does the Secretary of State's duty go beyond the words of the amendment and take into account the legislative intent behind the language of the amendment?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, the statute says that the title shall be appropriate, and it says that it shall be approved by the Attorney General. The reason for the approval is to make sure that it is appropriate. Further, this is one of the issues that is before the court. And so that is going to be decided by the court as to what is appropriate. With respect to your question about whether things in addition to the actual words of the amendment are considered in that, I'm hoping that the justices will provide us with answers to that.
All right. Senator
so, Mr. Chair, it would seem to me that if it's whatever was is appropriate, it's not just simply the language, which sometimes can be read differently by different people, but clearly the legislative intent, which, as I recall, on the Senate floor, legislative intent was repeated quite often and clearly ignored in this title that Secretary of State Ritchie chose to put forth.
Mr. Chair, on that point,
Senator
I
Goodwin.
Just wonder if we're getting into an area where the court is going to be making some decisions on that that we probably shouldn't be asking questions.
We're going to thank you, Senator. We're going to move on. Thank you, Mr. Black, for
thank
being here today.
Thank
I
you,
just,
Mr. Chairman.
I just have a couple of questions for the Attorney General, if I may.
Good morning. I think it's still morning. Okay.
I'm trying to get you back to work, sir.
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Before I ask the question, state your name.
My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm a member of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I'm the state Solicitor General.
Well, thank you for your patience, Mr. Gilbert, in being here today. I put together some questions, and I do not believe in I mentioned the reason that we started late today is because we have client attorney privileges. I understand that that was not waived, and we're very restrictive in some of your answers. But I think I have some questions that have been asked of me by citizens that I believe we can go down that path. They're pretty simple. One, Minnesota Statute 8.06 reads, The Attorney General shall act as the attorney for all state officers in all matters pertaining to their official duties. And the question that I'm being asked is, are we or why is not the Attorney General's office representing the Secretary of State in the cases?
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond. First of all, just to clarify what you indicated about attorney-client privilege and attorney obligations, what we've been talking about, as you well know, and Senator Newman's been very helpful as well, is that there's an obligation on the part of attorneys under Rule 4.2 of the Rules of Professional Responsibility not to discuss an ongoing litigated matter with parties to litigation. As it turns out, I found out at 4 o'clock yesterday, Senator Perry, that you are a party to some litigation that was brought yesterday, as was Senator Ortman, and that would seem to be even a surprise to you this morning. So it's certainly new off the press. I then asked, and I thought it would be a simple request, that the attorney representing you and Senator Ortman consent under this Rule 4.2, because that's what needs to be done, to my discussing the merits of that case and related cases with you. And Senator Newman's been very helpful in trying to facilitate conversation with your counsel, and your counsel has finally decided not to consent because of the pendency of the litigation and the court hearing that's coming up on July 31. So I am not really able to get into anything, as far as I'm concerned, even things that are intertwined. And I think everything is intertwined when it comes to the kinds of questions that you're asking today. So with all due respect and based on Rule 4.2 and attorney-client privilege issues, I would prefer not to respond to any questions today in light of what your counsel has indicated.
I appreciate that explanation, and so we'll honor that.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Your Honor, I feel like I'm in court already, although you're the honorable senator, certainly. But I do have copies of the briefs that have been filed by the Attorney General's office on behalf of the Secretary of State with respect to the title issue in the same-sex marriage case, so to speak. I'm happy to leave that with you if you would like. I can't make any comment on it in light of what we've already talked about. But if you'd like, I can certainly leave you copies so at least you can see what the legal position is. I noticed that you were asking some questions of Mr. Black, and the brief does respond to many of those questions.
That would be appreciated, okay, sir.
Let me do that. And who should I leave them with?
Would you hand them to Lucas back in the—
Okay. I will. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Any further questions, unless there's any other testimony that anyone in the audience that we're not aware of would have? Any other questions, final comments? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to say that I must, although I appreciate the attempt to really bring to the committee members' attention, you know, about the calls that we receive from constituents and individuals who are concerned about the decisions we make. I feel that this hearing started with very strong accusations based on those calls that, Mr. Chairman, you have received. I was hoping that during this hearing we would have had the opportunity to hear from those individuals who do not have strong party affiliation about how the Secretary of State has conducted his business and how that had been really interpreted as a really campaigning. I would have hoped to hear from people at the county level who are being trained on how to implement the decisions that we make here, and that did not happen today. And just for public information, I want to make sure the public know that this hearing does cost money. So taxpayers will be paying per diem to the people who are around the table, as well as paying for our expenses and travel expenses. So there is a cost to the work that we do here today.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope what's clear to the public as we went through the constitutional provisions that are at issue and the statutory provisions that are at issue is there are very few things where the legislature can act without a signature from the governor. Constitutional amendments is one area in which the Constitution allows us to do that. And when you've got a case out there, the Stearns case, that says that part of the constitutional directive to the legislature is to direct the manner in which the ballot measure is presented to the people, there is no, in my view, legal reason, obviously, for the Secretary of State to change this. And I would submit that there is only one reason to not accept the title from the legislature, and that is that the Secretary of State, who has made his position on this issue very clear, nobody can deny that the Secretary of State opposes this photo ID amendment, is changing the title in a way to help his side of the issue succeed. We in Minnesota have a right to expect better. Yes, there are partisan elections for constitutional officers, Secretary of State, Attorney General, et cetera. But once those people are placed in their roles, whether Democrat or Republican, they have a duty to serve all the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and to use Secretary Ritchie's own words in his letter to Chief Justice Gilday, perform the ministerial function. Our Secretary of State has crossed the line in this particular instance and is being a partisan. And that is something that Minnesotans should not be happy about.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, in my opinion, this constitutional amendment is partisan to begin with, but the Stearns County case was not asking whether or not the title was formed by the Secretary of State, because had that been the question, it should be provided by the Secretary of State, because had that been the question, the answer surely would have been yes, because of current statute 204D.15 that requires, not asks or says maybe he should or, you know, he could do it. It says he shall do it. So I really think if that was the question, that court case, which obviously it wasn't, then it would have been a different decision. So I think we need to be fair about this. And the Secretary of State went through the process that says right here in statute. Made his decision on the title, sent it to the Attorney General. Attorney General approved it, sent it back, and the law was followed to the T. So I really believe that this is an issue over nothing.
All right. With that, I would just like to end with a final comment. I am deeply disappointed that Secretary Ritchie and Attorney General Lori Swanson did not fulfill what I believe is their obligation to sit before the citizens of this state and answer questions. I am disappointed. I've always believed that they are better people than what they showed us today. My next action, whether it is to move forward and continue this investigation and look, will be made soon. And that could include different avenues. I will still take written testimony if somebody would like to submit, and will be in the minutes. As to the accusations, I believe there are still folks willing to come forward. I believe this committee hearing will open the door to that. I believe we will hear more from election judges and those who have sat in front of the Secretary of State and his staff. I believe now they understand that there is a belief that he is overstepping his bounds. I'm concerned that the Attorney General is not representing the Secretary of State, which I believe is also extra cost to the citizens of the state. And this is a serious matter, and we need to continue to address it and follow it, and with open transparency, which I believe this committee has done today. I'm still not sure that our Secretary of State didn't violate 211B06 based on some of the comments I've heard from the election officials in statements that our Secretary of State and his staff have made at their meetings, that they might not, that they could, in fact, fall underneath that statute. That will be a decision that this chair will also make in the coming days. So with that, ma'am, did you have something that you wanted to say? You would have to come up to the microphone, ma'am, and introduce yourself. And please state your name.
Beverly Moreland.
Ms. Mormon, you had a question?
Yes, I was just wondering, was Mark Ritchie and the Attorney General supposed to be here today?
Their presence was requested by the committee.
Well, I was just wondering why the union people sitting right directly behind me knew about a half an hour before the meeting started that they weren't coming.
They were
discussing it.
Right. They were. We were informed that they would be sending representatives instead of appearing on their own behalf.
It just reminds me of the people in Wisconsin that didn't want to vote on something, so they took off for another state.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, committee members, thank you for your time. This committee is adjourned.